Welcome, this is KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org on the internet. This is the Health and Happiness Show presented Monday evenings at 7 p.m. and Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. on KGVM. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. We discuss topics mostly regarding mental health, but virtually anything that might help us be healthier and happier. Our show has originally conceived as a product of the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association and still has that connection. Dr. Suzanne now introduces the program.
Why should we protect our access to the outdoors and all of its components? Is it truly necessary? Researchers tell us it is vital for mental health, particularly children. A growing group of medical and psychological professionals are recommending time in nature as one of their most effective therapy tools. But who takes care of nature for us? Who ensures and works to keep our flora and fauna alive and abundant? Today we have a guest who spent much of his lifetime building and protecting our natural world, a true crusader for a beautiful and verdant outdoors. Please help me welcome Senator Pat Flowers. And we'd like to mention that prior to working with the legislature, he spent many years working as the regional supervisor for the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Group. Hi, Pat. Tell us, how did you get interested in that work? What prompted you toward that field?
Good morning, Suzanne. Good morning, Alice. Happy to be with you this morning. I suppose that goes back to my childhood, and as I grew up, had the opportunity to fish and a little hunting with my dad, and of course get outside as much as I could. And I think based on that, I had one of the probably the unique experience of taking a test in high school to show kind of what your orientation was or where your interests lie and kind of where you should go. And lo and behold, the results were that I should go into natural resource management. Uh-huh. And this is when I was living in Ohio. And so from there, I actually pursued it, and it turns out that test was kind of dead on. It turned out to be a great career for me and certainly fed my soul in many ways. And I started in forestry and went to a forestry school in Missoula and spent the first half of my career, about 15 years, with state forestry and some with the Forest Service, and then moved from there into fish, wildlife, and parks. And I think that shift allowed me an opportunity to take a mid-career step into a piece of natural resource management that I was familiar with and had worked with as a land manager on the land management side. But this step into working with fish, wildlife, and parks allowed me to more directly deal with population management of both fish and wildlife and parks recreation. So it was a wonderful shift for me, and I really feel fortunate to have had the career that I had.
Well, we just want to right here and now thank you for helping to monitor and preserve all of our beautiful outdoors, the forests, which benefit us each and every one, and the animals and the wildlife. And so would you, while we're on the topic of how you began, would you recommend to other people out there, especially young people looking for something to do, is this a good area of occupation? Are there plenty of options and potentials there?
I think it's a great career myself. If you're intention is to get into a, you know, an occupation that provides a lot of fulfillment, and you're oriented towards conservation or outdoor interests, I think it's, you'd be very satisfied with it. If your intent is to make a lot of money, it's probably not the way to go. It's, I think you're paid fairly, but it's not a huge money maker. And so I think that's the choice. But I think there are jobs available, more jobs now probably than when I got out of school. There's a lot of uncertainty right now also with the federal administration and
yes.
some of the downsizing they're doing with federal agencies. And obviously, who knows what will come out of this federal shutdown that we're in right now.
Yes, it's actually a big concern, I'm sure, for everyone in the listening audience. What's going to happen? And already we've noticed the cutbacks have had an impact on driving through and being a part of Montana.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm sure you're reading some of the same press that I'm reading, Suzanne. And it sounds like, although Yellowstone Park is open, certainly with a skeleton staff, and I think the experience will be different than normal this time of year.
Yes, I remember having some folks from the park's oversight on the show, and we were commending them that in all over the state of Montana, as we've traveled to different parks and recreation areas, we had never been to a public restroom that wasn't clean, plenty of tissue paper, and we just didn't know how they managed all of that. And they did it so perfectly. It was like 100%. Who does that? And now our hearts just kind of quiver a little bit as we think about how they're managing all this change.
Yeah, it puts a big strain on those staff that are still remaining, trying to keep a place like Yellowstone open, which is such a national, international gem. Really puts a lot of strain on them, and I'm sure there are things that inherently have to slip a bit when you're operating with such a reduced staff. So hard on those folks, hard on the people that can't come to work. I think most people that are in this field of, whether it's parks and recreation or fish management, wildlife management, are very personally committed to their work. And so when you're told, you know, you can't come to work and you can't get paid until they sort out this budget, it's hard, I think really hard on those folks. Not to mention the financial impacts.
Yes. And from another viewpoint, we had the manager, the director at the Bozeman International Airport on not long ago, and he said they'd really noticed a drop-off in people coming from all over the world, which was their usual, to go see Yellowstone and Montana and the bison and the wolves. They said that that's really having an impact with the new tariffs and charges for people to even visit, that it's really seeing a change even at Yellowstone Airport.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that, but I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise. When costs go up for folks, that affects their travel choices, and certainly the tariffs are one component of that.
We wanted to ask also, Pat, what were some of your main initiatives when you were working with the forestry and with wildlife? What, as you reflect, were some high points that you'd like to tell us about?
Oh, sure. I'll start on the forestry end. As I said, I spent the first half of my career partly with the Forest Service. I started professionally with the Forest Service Fire Lab in Riverside, California, and worked on a fire planning model there, which was really a great, professionally a great introduction into the forestry world, and I went from there to state forestry, and ultimately managed their what they call the Forest Management Bureau over there. And probably the highlight of that time, other than the people that I worked with, who I loved and I think are amazing, hardworking professional foresters and hydrologists and soil scientists. Beyond that, the highlight was that we produced the first state forest land management plan. And it was at the time when the Forest Service was putting out their forest level management plans all over the country. And so we had the opportunity to do something similar for the state. And that forest land management plan really laid out a path forward and a guiding document for how we were going to manage our state, our forested state trust lands. It was a several-year project, and I consider it one of my kind of most important pieces of work that I was involved with. So that was on the forestry end. On the with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, there were several issues that were at the top of mind. The first one that was laid on my plate was to develop a river recreation plan for the Big Hole and Beaverhead Rivers. And if you're not familiar with the consternation surrounding river recreation, this probably won't make sense, but it's full of a lot of strong feelings on who should be allowed to use the river, when, for what purposes, and that sort of thing. And so it came off the heels of a legislative initiative to solve that problem on those two rivers, and then ultimately a court settlement with a direction from the court to for the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks to go to work and find a solution with interested parties. And so we spent, I think, 4 years working on that. And ultimately, we were able to develop a set of river recreation rules for those two rivers that are still in place. And so that's been, you know, over 20 years ago now. And in my opinion, anyway, I think they've been very effective at managing crowding, managing use on that, on those two rivers. So that's one piece that I'm really pleased with, and it's endured. Another place where I spent a lot of time was working on bison management issues. That's a multi-jurisdictional, multi-agency sort of challenge, and it involves Yellowstone National Park, obviously involved Fish, Wildlife, and Parks from the perspective of managing wildlife populations in the state. The Forest Service was involved, Department of Livestock was involved because of the risk for livestock related to the brucellosis that many bison carry. And there was a couple of other federal agencies involved also. And the bottom line was I probably spent, and this seems outlandish, but I probably spent 30% of my time over 15 years working on just that issue. And it was required a lot of meetings with all those agencies who have really different missions, and working with all of them to try to get us to come together to find a solution that would kind of comply with all of our different agency mandates and the interests that we represented. And my opinion, at the time, we came a long way with that collaborative work, and I was really pleased with how we ultimately implemented this bison management plan. It was still frustrating for some of the interests surrounding it, but I thought we made a lot of strides. One of the things as a piece of that I worked on personally was negotiating an easement with the Church Universal and Triumphant who owns property just north of the park, just north of Gardner, on the west side of the river primarily. And that easement then allowed bison to migrate north out of the park and would be welcome on the Church Universal Triumphant lands. And that was a key kind of cork in the bottle, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed them to move north, at least up to Yankee Jim Canyon. And that is their moving north was part of the normal migration in that particular component of the Britain Yellowstone. So that was a key piece of that that I felt really good about. And that easement is still in place for now.
It seems to me that you've had to become somewhat of a genius at just talking with people. When I think of all the communication involved, like that 4 years working on that particular plan, I just wonder how many headaches came about as a result of those very difficult efforts to communicate with varying interests and varying groups.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That was a big part of my job, and which translated actually really well to the legislature.
Oh, yeah.
I think what I... one of the things I learned in that whole process is that in working with kind of different interests that are affected by a particular issue, in this case bison, as long as we treated those interests with respect and negotiated or conversed in good faith, so to speak, you can build trust, and with that trust, you can find solutions. And it worked. It really didn't matter the issue, whether it was wolf management, elk management, bison, grizzly bears, that those same principles applied, and I think that's how you find success.
Absolutely. Communication was the key to all of this effort. I wonder, too, if you could share with us, is there a Native American component to the talks about bison?
Yes. They have Aboriginal hunting rights in areas surrounding Yellowstone. And so we met regularly with the tribes that were expressing those hunting rights. And, they were part of the negotiations were at the table with all the other managers on how we were going to implement the bison management plan. We had, in addition to their role as part of the managers group that would meet routinely, we also met, Fish, Wildlife and Parks met specifically with all the tribes that had expressed Aboriginal hunting rights, I think at least once a year, to talk about how that kind of season or year of hunting was going to unfold and try and coordinate state hunters of bison, and there's a limited number of those that are issued by permit, with all their Aboriginal hunters, which are not, their kind of season structure is not quite as structured as the states. And so it required a lot of coordination so we wouldn't kind of be stepping on each other's toes and ensure some level of satisfaction for state hunters as well as Aboriginal hunters.
That all just seems fairly impossible. Congratulations on that high level of golden communication.
we had fits and starts on that, and sometimes it worked better than others, but I think it worked better having those regular meetings to at least attempt to try and coordinate.
It just seems like 4 years of talks led to something that has lasted 20 years now. So whatever effort it took was worthy, Pat. Thank you for doing that for Montana.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I was wondering, too, about career changes, which you've made several, and a person can segue from one challenge to yet another. Was there a big component about nature and wildlife when you decided to enter the political realm?
You know, I was, I think, initially motivated, to be honest with you, by the 2016 election, presidential election. And after that happened, I have two daughters, two stepdaughters, and one was back east. I can't remember whether she was in school or working at that time, and called me. And her question that following morning, that Wednesday morning following the election, her question was, how could this happen? And then I had another stepdaughter who was still at home at the time, and she came out in tears wondering whether she had to, you know, what that meant for her birth control pills that she got and that sort of thing. And both of those really hit me in a powerful way, and kind of a gut level kind of father sort of thing, wanting to protect his kids. And I think that's what motivated me really initially to jump into the fray of politics, because I really hadn't been involved at all since maybe student council in high school. So that was the spark. And I would say that my as that kind of burned into an actual effort to run for office, my motivation then became a lot of my motivation was related to conservation and natural resource issues. And I was concerned about eroding public access. I was concerned about eroding fish and wildlife habitat and water quality. And so all those have been motivating factors and continue to motivate me over the last 7 years in the legislature. And fortunately, I was allowed to serve on the Fish and Wildlife Committee for the last four terms of the legislature, as well as the Senate Natural Resources Committee. So it really gave me the opportunity to kind of be directly involved there. In addition, I've had the honor of serving on the Environmental Quality Council for the last 7 years. So I've really had the opportunity to do what I can and represent what, you know, my interests in terms of conservation.
Well, we did ask you what you would say to young people considering a career in fish and wildlife, but now we're going to ask, what would you say to young people considering a career in politics now that you've been there 7 years?
Yeah, that's a harder question.
Yeah.
No doubt, and a good one. It is a really a rough place to be right now, I'll be honest with you. It's so polarized that it's... that you really have to have some thick skin to thrive in that environment. And that said, if you've got, you know, if younger folks have, you know, a passion for making a difference, which a lot do, thank God, and I think it's a great place to go, and I think you can make a difference. And the state legislature has a big impact on our life. I'm not sure folks realize how much of our kind of day-to-day support that we get from state government affects our lives, and how many decisions that are made at the state level really affect people's lives, whether it's, you know, food stamp SNAP benefits or Medicaid or affordable housing efforts or healthcare. A lot of that is affected by state policy. So for young people that have all those concerns, and I think they do because they're trying to scrap and find a way to make a living here, you can have a big impact. And so I would encourage folks to, yes, absolutely run for something, because it's important that we have younger voices at the table, and at the same time, be realistic that it's hard work, really hard work, and it will test anybody, I don't care what their age is, to kind of stretch themselves. And I definitely felt that over my tenure for sure.
My goodness, when I think of you sitting for 4 years talking with people at regular meetings and finally coming to a conclusion, I feel that even the state legislature is no match for you, Pat.
Yeah, well, I don't know. This last session, it sure felt like a match for me.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, on a little bit of a different topic, it seems like there's been a lot of legislative action about wolves lately. Have you been interested in that conversation?
Yes, I have. And I dub it 10,000 new ways to kill more wolves.
Tell us about
what it feels like. I think there are some interests. And a lot of them are focused in northwestern Montana or western Montana. And those interests have been frustrated that wolves have come on the landscape over the last, you know, really 3 decades probably, that there have been kind of unacceptable impacts on big game populations. And so they've really worked hard, fought hard to control wolf numbers more aggressively than we have in the past. And I've resisted those efforts. I don't think they're warranted in general for the state. And the reason being is if you look at wolf numbers over the last decade, they're really pretty stable. They're not on a continued increase. They stabilized around 11 or 1,200 wolves, something like that. And likewise, at the same time, we've seen livestock depredations, and that means livestock who are taken or, you know, killed by wolves. We've seen those numbers stabilize and or go down over the last, I don't have the graphs in front of me, but over the last 5 or 10 years. And also at the same time, you've seen polling that's shown public acceptance of having wolves on the landscape has just gotten higher and higher. So when I look at all those trends, and then I look at efforts that we've got to reduce the wolf population in half or more, as argued by some of these advocates for the legislation that's come forward in the last several sessions, I don't think the facts bear that out. What they would argue is there are just unacceptable impacts in northwest Montana. And if that's the case, and they are able to convince the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commission of that, amid probably some other voices that would argue the other way, even in northwestern Montana. But if they're able to convince the commission of that, then the commission has the power to make specific changes in quotas and that sort of thing for that particular region of the state. But to extend these broader, I think, more blunt instrument solutions across the rest of the state does not make sense. And so that's why I've worked against all of those efforts.
Yeah, I understood they were wanting to expand to each hunter could kill 15 wolves per license, and then renew the license and kill 15 more.
Yeah, it's kind of gross. And I have been a student of and a real advocate for hunter ethics, and to me that doesn't comport with good ethics. It just seems over the top. And that's my take.
A 2021 study said that wolves do not pose a significant threat to human safety. In fact, they found that the risk of a wolf attack on a human in North America is so low it can't be calculated. And they also further said that wolves do not decimate prey populations like, I guess, deer and elk, etc. In fact, they improve herd health by selectively preying on sick, weak, and injured individuals. So they actually can be facilitative for nature.
I think that's true. The only maybe difference I would have with that is, from my experience, they can have, you know, in certain circumstances, they can have a definite impact on big game populations.
Okay.
Some of it is displacement. So, you know, the prey populations will change their patterns to avoid getting killed by wolves. And they learn pretty quickly what's, you know, vulnerable ground for them and what isn't. So I think that happens. The other thing that I've experienced is two places where we saw notable changes and declines in big game populations were north of Yellowstone Park, both on the West Yellowstone side and north, and, you know, into the Gallatin, and then in the Gardner area and north. And part of the explanation for that is we were really measured about how many wolves we were killing adjacent to the park, and they still are, and I think rightfully so. And there's very little, like if you look from Yankee Jim south to Gardner, and really from the Gallatin Canyon down to the park, there aren't many livestock or livestock operations left in those areas. And so there are no wolf removals that come as a result of wildlife or livestock depredation. And so populations have been allowed to kind of naturally expand. Wolf populations have been allowed to naturally expand there. Mm-hmm. And so we have seen, and particularly, well, in both those places, we've seen pretty sustained declines in what were maybe historically high levels of elk populations in particular. So that's I guess just a little caveat that I would apply there based on your comments.
Well, yeah, that study was from several years back, and I think you're very current on this, and thank you for that good information.
Sure.
And there's a recent survey by Fish and Wildlife that said Montanans show positive attitudes toward grizzly bears and support the presence of grizzly bears within the state. Have you had much experience with bears, Pat?
I have. Yeah, I served on the Yellowstone Ecosystem Managers Group, which is also a multi-agency group with land managers and then wildlife managers, actually in both, in all three states of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And once again, it was one of these collaborative efforts where we met regularly. And at that point, we were trying to develop a conservation strategy, which is part of a requirement of the Endangered Species Act in order to take critters off of the endangered species listing. And so we did that together over, again, many years of meetings and trying to get agreement on how we wanted to manage habitat to ensure that, and populations to ensure that bears would thrive in the long run. And we got to the point where we did agree on a conservation strategy, and that was adopted. We moved to delist bears as a result of that, and it was blocked in court. It's been blocked in court another time since then. But I think there is, I think at a public level, I think in general, there's a lot of support for grizzly bears. At the same time, I think people have a healthy respect for what it means to have them on the landscape, and that certainly changes our recreation somewhat. As a result, or should. Mm-hmm. And it also changes livestock management in grizzly bear habitat. And for the most part, we've found ways to accommodate them in what has become kind of their primary habitat adjacent to the park and on into Montana.
This is such good work, and we would like to ask, as somebody who's been intimate with forests and with all these animals, just to get practical for a minute and give us your best tips on bear safety for people walking about in the trails around Montana.
Well, I think, you know, most people know, you know, if you're hiking in bear habitat, it's good to make a lot of noise. It's good to not hike alone, because typically if you're not hiking alone, you're chatting away anyway, and that helps warn bears that you're in the area. And I think almost entirely bears will avoid contact if they can. And so if they know you're around, they're going to be in more secure places where you don't run into them. One of the challenges is kind of surprise encounters, and that's when things can become pretty unpredictable. If bears in particular have young with them, their natural instinct is to protect them, and so I think that's where we see some of the maulings that occur, and that's where always carrying bear spray in bear country is essential. And it's not foolproof, but it can avoid a lot of personal injury and the loss of bears that can come with that also. Those are probably the big things. Some people prefer to carry firearms to protect themselves, and I get that. But there's a lot of work that's been done that shows in general, for the average person, it's easier to deploy bear spray to stop a bear encounter than it is with a firearm, because people are, alarmed when it happens, and it's hard to be kind of calm enough to use a firearm in a way to protect yourself. So I'm a big advocate, and I know the agencies are big advocates for people recreating or working in bear country to have bear spray with them.
What about the use of bells? I know there's, like on Amazon, you can get what they call bear bells to wear.
Sure.
To make quite a bit of noise as you walk along.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what some folks do, and it's been around a long time, and it's time-tested. You know, you make noise, whether it's bells or anything else. Again, it alerts the bears, so they'll generally get out of the way, so you won't even know they're there when you pass by. They don't, for the most part, do not want these confrontations either. So, yeah, bells can be real effective.
Yeah, and if you just have them like you keep bear spray, you could keep bear bells. And so I think my favorite way to have a bear encounter is by not having it face-to-face.
Yeah. And, or from a distance.
Yeah.
A long distance.
Yeah. Yeah, at a distance. So is there any big difference between a black bear and a brown bear that we need to know about?
Yeah, well, the two species of bears here are black bears and grizzly bears, and important to note that black bears can be brown also.
Oh.
So just being brown doesn't mean it's a grizzly bear. There are some other characteristics related to kind of the snout. The snout on a grizzly bear has a concave look on the top, and a black bear, whether they're brown phase, black bear, or black, have same characteristics in terms of their snout, which is more concave on top. Also, you can look at the size of the ears. The black bear's ears are larger, tend to be more upright, and the grizzly bears look smaller. The last thing is the grizzly bears, of course, have that hump on their back behind their head. So those are kind of the observable characteristics that you can. They're not as easy to pick out depending on the lighting and the angles as you might think, but if you kind of look at all three of those things, you can usually figure out what's what. I don't know whether Fish, Wildlife, and Parks still has their bear identification test online, but if they do, it's kind of fun to take because it shows bears in different lightings from different angles, and they ask you to identify whether it's a black bear or a grizzly bear. And even professionals or people that are familiar with those characteristics struggle on some of those photos. So it's kind of a fun thing to do if people want to just test themselves and see if they can recognize it.
Does it matter when you're out on the trail whether it's a black bear or a brown bear?
A grizzly bear or a black bear. Grizzly bears, I think, pose a little more risk. And I think it does matter. And so it's probably a good thing to be aware of.
Okay.
And that's not universal. I mean, there certainly attacks have occurred from black bears as well. But I think there's a general consensus that grizzly bears pose probably a little more threat.
Are there any good natural places to go to view these animals? Or I know that there's at least one place near here that there's some bears in captivity. I didn't know if that was good or bad, but how do we view them?
Yeah, probably the best place is we're so lucky to live so close to Yellowstone Park. And, you know, you can get lucky during the middle of the day, but early in the morning is a good, very early in the morning is a good time to travel the park and look for bears in places like the Lamar. There's some, really in several places across the park and the park and direct folks there. I've certainly spotted them at that time of the morning, and that's a good time to spot wolf activity as well. So wolves are a little more apparent, can be more apparent throughout the day, but early morning is a good time to go. And yeah, it's hard to find a better place for locating a bear and watching a bear than Yellowstone National Park.
We have some friends and co-workers at the station, Bob and J.P. Pomnikowski, who served on the Senate previously. And two or three days ago, the cat wanted out at 4 in the morning. And so Bob got up to let the cat out, stood there, let the cat back in, and then saw a bear right in their backyard on the outskirts of Bozeman. So, and our kids visiting from New York City went to the French Bakery downtown, and coming out as they drove down the block, there was a bear right in Longview.
Not Longview.
Bozeman.
We used to live in Longview. Yep.
Yeah, Bozeman. And so how can we encourage bears not to come into the city and get in trouble?
Yeah, great question. This time of year, in the fall, bears are trying to, their natural kind of habit is to stock up on as much food as they can choke down to allow them to go into their hibernation. And so there are lots of attractants in a place like Bozeman with fruit trees and bird feeders and barbecue grills and that sort of thing. So probably the best thing that any particular landowner, homeowner here in Bozeman can do is take away those attractants, and particularly in the fall. And if you have fruit trees, for example, pick the fruit as soon as it's ripe and get it off the ground, because the longer it's on the tree, you can, you know, there's a fair chance you're going to have a bear find it and get up in the tree and be, you know, busting branches and that sort of thing, clambering around and in your yard and running around, and, you know, the kind of the risk that goes with it can be kind of a spectacle that some people enjoy, but there is some level of risk with it also.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of the basics of what you can do, and obviously secure your garbage too, so don't leave, you know, a can of garbage outside your house that's not in a bear-proof container. Keep it in your garage until it's the day that you have to put it out for a pickup. And those are the basics. But chances are, even with all that, this is just the time of year when bears are in town, and routinely you're going to see fish, wildlife, and parks darting, you know, tranquilizing bears and trees in the university area. And catching them in a net and transporting them out of town. I think that's probably just going to keep happening.
Yeah, we watched a moose downtown Bozeman being transported that same way. It was quite an operation. And about 8 years ago now, when we were considering moving to Bozeman and our grandchildren were here, they were both in the high school. And as I was going to work that morning, over the national news came a story. There is a bear in the high school in Bozeman, Montana. I remember stopping, pulling off the road, and calling and telling my daughter, "You all are coming back home right now." But it turns out it was simply a baby bear. And again, they brought him out and took him back to the forest, or took care of him. And that brings us to another question we had. There's some centers that provide for bears that the saying is that they can't be released back into the wilderness. Are these legitimate places to go and see bears? Should we support these groups, or is it kind of taking advantage of bears?
Well, I guess it kind of depends on who you talk to. I'm actually familiar with both the Discovery Center in Yellowstone, or in West Yellowstone, and the I forget the name of the place on the pass, and worked with particularly that area when it was permitted. And I think they do. Both those operations, I think, run themselves in a way that's as responsible as possible. It does give, you know, the general public a chance to see bears that they might otherwise not be able to see, and hopefully have an appreciation for them just by seeing them, even in that setting. I think that's the positive. I think they do what they can to support conservation efforts. I know that the Discovery Center had taken a couple what we call problem bears that had gotten into trouble, or that were presenting, you know, were getting habituated by food and, you know, appeared to be a human threat. And they had taken a few bears in the past, and taken them in, and then they became animals that they had available to that they housed and fed and allowed for display. And it probably depends on who you talk to and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I know that both those organizations work hard to be responsible in their role as a place where people can see bears that they might otherwise not be able to see in nature.
How can we as citizens support the efforts to take care of our animals and wildlife, and also see that legislation is appropriate and not inappropriate regarding them?
Well, I think two things. One is there's ongoing efforts to figure out how to manage wildlife, and it's often comes in the form of soliciting public opinion, and that happens at the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Fish and Wildlife Commission level, where they set rules on how many animals are going to be hunted and that sort of thing. So that's one place, is just kind of following the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commission and weighing in. Also, there's a lot that goes on with individual land management efforts, whether it's a timber sale or a road building or a change in a grazing permit. Those, if they're happening, all require public input, and the public can engage on any of those issues and weigh in, and a lot of folks do, to express their interests, concerns about ensuring that fish and wildlife habitats maintained. At a kind of a broader level, every 2 years the legislature meets, and inevitably there's a number of bills that affect things like wolf management and beyond that, and the public has the opportunity during the course of the legislative session to weigh in on those bills. And one of the benefits that's a holdover from the pandemic is that we allowed for remote participation by the public in hearings on any bill. And so you don't have to travel to Helena. You can sign up online. It's usually 24 hours ahead of the hearing, and offer your testimony and opinion on any particular bill, in this case related to fish and wildlife management or conservation interests.
Is there any particular issue right now that you would like for us to weigh in on as citizens out here?
Oh, that's a great question. I am not aware of anything right now. Certainly at a legislative level, we're in an interim period between sessions, so there isn't any direct way that the public can weigh in on legislative issues related to fish and wildlife. At a local level, I'm a little flat-footed on this one. I didn't really prepare or do any research on kind of where they're taking comments on particular issues at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we could check into it and see, as individuals out here wanting to help in the process and the protection of our wonderful mental health assets in the forests and in the animals. Yes. We wanted to ask just another real concrete kind of question. I know that a lot of restaurants in Montana have an unusual offering of bison or buffalo meat. Are there special herds that are kept just like cattle that provide that? Or do they, how do they procure that meat without endangering our herds?
Yeah, that bison that's served in restaurants is entirely what I would call ranched. So they're managed as livestock.
Okay.
And so, for example, if you go out on the Flying D Ranch that's owned by Ted Turner, you can see large herds of bison out there. It's really kind of a neat experience. It's not Yellowstone National Park, but you can see these bison on the landscape, and they're large herds, and it can be a pretty neat experience. In addition, there's smaller operations like North Bridger Bison, who also markets their bison and manages their herds, I think, really responsibly. and harvest them, so to speak, in the field. And so they're, I think, a really great company as well. And that's really where all that restaurant level bison is coming from, are those kinds of operations.
That's good.
Another very concrete question. What should we say, buffalo or bison?
I think either works.
So they're about the same thing in your estimation, a bison and a buffalo?
Yeah, basically. I mean, there are woods bison and plains bison. There's some kind of finer distinctions. But yeah, I think those kinds of distinctions are probably only really important to biologists that are quite committed to the field of bison management.
Oh, good. We don't have to worry about it then.
No, you don't. No, either works.
Well, we are getting close to the end of the show, and we wonder if there's something we haven't asked or something you would like to share with us, Pat, about this whole topic and area.
Well, the only thing that I would share is my own perspective is our natural environment in this state is really the foundation for what makes this place special. And so I think I would encourage all our listeners to do whatever they can to ensure that we maintain that foundation in a way that's going to be healthy for our kids and grandkids in the long run. And that comes to or relates to not only fish and wildlife populations, but all of our natural resources, including water quality and water quantity. Those are going to be challenges that we face down the road. And I hope people can remain committed to that, because I do truly believe that our kind of personal well-being, our mental health, our emotional health, and our economic health are all dependent on keeping those resources as sound and healthy as possible. So that, I guess that would be my final message.
That is just well said, and I think you're right that one of the prime mental health concerns of our age is what is happening to our environment and how can we do anything at all that would have an impact. So I think you've shown us some ways that we could maybe address that in this show, Pat, and we really thank you for your lifetime of helping to support those very important basic parts of our lives.
Well, you're welcome. It's been my great honor, and I'm going to continue to do everything I can on that same track. So I've really enjoyed the opportunity to talk with you, Suzanne, and Arliss, and thanks so much for having me.
We want to thank you very much, and we thank Gallatin Valley for listening today to our program, Health and Happiness, and we look forward to talking to special guests and letting you listen to them again. Thank you again, Gallatin Valley. Thank you, Senator.
You're welcome.